Hi, my name is Bill, and I'm an alcoholic. Wow. I was waiting for more to happen. All of a sudden, I'm up here. Anyway, congratulations to the gentleman with 2 days. If you're anything like I was when I was 2 days, you don't even know where the hell you are right now. As a matter of fact, like a friend of mine says, I don't even remember getting sober because I was drunk at the time, you know. But seriously, I'd like to offer you all the best, and please stay with us. You know, as I say, it's much easier to stay than it is to come back. I say that from personal experience. And you've just received a book from a gentleman with 45 years of sobriety. When you stop and think about that, he did it one day at a time. For an alcoholic, it's an incredible feat. You should see what you look like from up here. I mean, what a fantastic sight. The miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I think we ought to, you know, sometimes I just take for granted where all this came from. You know, and it comes from a higher power and AA. I think we owe our higher power a good hand this morning, don't you? I've had a fantastic weekend. You know, I'm supposed to say something like that, you know, because... You know, the committee worked so hard and all of this, but from the bottom of my heart, I had a fantastic weekend. Oh, no, thank you. Thank you. And I'd like to thank Cookie, and I'd like to thank Laura, and I'd like to thank Susan. The work that goes into putting something like this on, my wife Bernadette and I are privileged to attend conventions from time to time and in various parts of the country, and you know, you don't realize, you know, everything that this started over a year ago, the work that began, and then here we are enjoying the fruits of all of that labor. It's really something. Anyway, I'd also like to thank my home group, the Leonard Park Group in Mount Kisco, for all the members that have turned out this morning to support me, and. And I need a lot of support. I'm not a bit nervous. I just lie a lot. I don't need notes to tell my story, but I'd like to share back with you some of the things that I got out of this weekend. All of these meetings are wonderful. And I've got something from every one of them. But I have to be honest and say that my favorites are the Alcathons. If something happens, I was sharing this with some friends of mine, something happens at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning in an Alcathon meeting. That just doesn't happen anywhere else. Maybe except in Mucci's bar at 3 o'clock. You know, when I used to sit there hovering over this platoon, you know, sharing with my fellow platoon artists or artists or whatever the hell they were, and when the truth of the drunk comes out. But something happens in these meetings. But from the very beginning, at the welcome meeting, Bill, our Canadian friend who's now a member of GSO, said something that hit me between the eyes. He said he came into Alcoholics Anonymous with a big ego problem. Ha, no fooling, you know. But he also said that, you know, he still has a touch of it. Ha ha, no fooling, you know. But he also said something which touched me, and he said that he and his wife found an apartment in a brownstone 2 doors down from where Bill and Lois Wilson lived on Clinton Street. Wow. Now, if that isn't God stuff, you know? I remember when I was doing some research for a project that I wrote, I would go over there and I would stand across the street from Clinton Street, where Lois and Bill lived and where, you know, the very early beginnings of what we have today, you know, took place. I was just awed. I guess what I'm trying to say is I'm so damn envious and jealous of where the hell they live, you know. And I'm sure they appreciate it. And then Ruth, the Al-Anon speaker, who I have the privilege of knowing from California, her and her husband Connie live in California part of the year. And she said something, and I never thought Al-Anons admitted this kind of stuff, you know, but being married to one. But no, I'm only teasing. And because no, the truth of the matter is I love Al-Anon. Without Al-Anon, I wouldn't be standing here. My wife and I wouldn't be together. Through Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon, my wife and I, on March 17th this past, celebrated our 44th wedding anniversary. Bruce said that, in telling her story, she said that she still falls back into her old patterns now and then, you know. This, of course, is after she talked about her character defects and shortcomings. But she said not as often as she used to. And that made me feel good because I do also fall back into my patterns from time to time. And then I went to an Alcathon meeting that night and found out why I fall back into my patterns from time to time. And a fellow named Misha, a wonderful young man from South Ozone Park, was leading a meeting on fear. And he talked about that, how fear triggers us falling back into our patterns, into our old character defects, into my character defects and shortcomings. That fear has always been the thing that led me around by the nose and continues at times to lead me around by the nose, and sometimes I'm not aware of it. When I suddenly burst out in anger, it takes me a while to realize where it came from. It's because I'm afraid of not getting something I want or losing something that I have. And I still have that because I'm still an alcoholic. As a matter of fact, my alcoholism is 37 years older than it was the day I walked in here. And I must never forget that, you know, that this disease continues to grow. And that's why I need to make my meetings. I need to be with my fellow members, and I need to be active in Alcoholics Anonymous. And then another young man at an Alcathon meeting, a young man named Carl, I think he's only 6 months sober, he sounded like he was 60 years sober. he talked about, he's a welder, and he talked about he was welding one day, and I guess there was a flash or something, and he was blinded. He was taken to the hospital, and they put bandages on his eyes, and he suddenly came to realize that all these years he had taken his sight for granted, and now that he no longer had it. And it only lasted 24 hours, but he said those 24 hours changed his life, that he began to stop taking things for granted. And that happened to me when I finally came back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I finally realized how blind I had been in so many ways, in so many areas of my life. And that you began to remove the bandages from my eyes and you let me see. But still today, I find myself taking things for granted, taking this life that you have helped me and God has given me for granted. You know, I'm a typical alcoholic. You know, Bill Wilson was once asked what was his shortest definition of alcoholism, and he said, I can define it in one word, more. What do you want? I want more. He said he always wanted doubles of everything to make himself feel better. Huh? Yeah, that sounds familiar. I always wanted doubles of everything. Make me feel better. Bigger house, bigger car, bigger this, bigger that, more of this, more of that. And I sometimes, you know, get angry with myself and get ashamed of myself that I can still be like that. But then I was at another Alcathon meeting, and I heard a young man from Brooklyn talk about how angry he was with himself because he couldn't understand why he wasn't more honest. Why in conversations he had to exaggerate. You know, my fish is bigger than your fish, you know. And I'm sitting there, he was sober about a year, and I'm sitting there saying to myself, where the hell have you been for the last 37 years? Your fish is still bigger than everybody else's. But what I've learned is I've learned more today about accepting myself as I am while trying to get better. You know, I spent a long time early on beating myself up for not being better or not growing faster and all that kind of stuff. I'm where I guess I'm supposed to be, and I'm trying to improve as each day goes on, and that's all I can expect of myself. I'm not taking it easy on myself, but I'm not beating myself up anymore. And there was a young lady at that meeting who was really impressed with some of the other speakers, you know, who talked about, like this one lady talked about, she said something that struck me, very simple thing, when she was talking about how she found her higher power and, you know, how disappointed she would get from time to time when she would pray and not get what she prayed for, and when disappointing things came into her life and she couldn't understand them. But she finally broke out of that and found a loving God, and she said, my God is always good, and so is mine. I wonder why he doesn't give me what I want right now when I work so damn hard for it. You know, I still find myself trying to manipulate him, you know. I'll do this for you if you do this for me, you know. But he's a good guy. My God is always good. And then this other young lady, and I met her out here just a little while ago, and she said, I wish I were better. I mean, I wish I could grow faster. I wish I could, you know, get more and whatnot. She said, I wish I could be like you, and I wish I could be like you, and I wish I could be like you. And the leader of the meeting smiled at her and said, but you are. You're just like us. You're an alcoholic. Yeah? And we're just like each other. That's why we're here. You know, I'm just like you, and you're just like me. I may look different. You know, I may have a few more pounds. You know, I may smell different. Gay may smell different, you know. That's an inside joke for those that weren't here for the banquet speech last night. He and his wife, Patty, Gay and his wife, Patty, just were fabulous last night. Another miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know? Of course, me, you know, I latch on to the stupid things, aside from the fact that, you know, he rode around this wonderful country on a railroad car for a long time and met his wonderful wife in a you know, how should we put it, a Bowery saloon in Ogden, Utah. She was 100 pounds heavier than she is now, and he hadn't taken a bath in 6 months, but it was love at first sight. Yeah. And then he joins this group in Utah, and he manages to get 90 days sobriety. And one of the old geezers at the meeting says, we're going to give you a certificate, so you just get up and tell us who you are and thankful for your sobriety. And so they gave him the certificate, and he gets up, and the old geezer's sitting over here, and he says, I'm gay, and I'm an alcoholic. And the old geezer says, we can help you with your drinking problem, but the other stuff, I don't know, you know. Yeah. I mean, we're but an Alcoholics Anonymous. You know? Yeah, I'm in the movie business, but you can't write stuff like that. Nobody'd believe it, you know? Oh, man, do I love AA. I mean, don't you love AA? Oh, man. Anyway, Bernard, my wife wanted to know why I was a spiritual speaker. No, she didn't really want to know why I was a spiritual speaker, because she knows I'm not a spiritual speaker. But you know, this is another one of God's funny jokes. Me being up here, you know, spiritual meeting, but she made me promise not to tell any of those stories I usually tell. So that's the way I'll be spiritual. But anyway, I'm gonna share with you, you know, a little bit of my story, and that's a spiritual thing, because, you know, I suffer from a spiritual malady, you know. Yes, it's a threefold disease. It's physical, it's mental, and it's spiritual, but it's primarily spiritual. I didn't know that at all when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was very sick physically. I was a walking fruitcake mentally, you know. But I was totally, absolutely, spiritually bankrupt. And I don't necessarily mean religiously, spiritually bankrupt. I was that, too. But what I was a guy who had once loved life. I loved, like so many of us, I loved playing ball. I loved being involved. I loved achieving. I had been a newspaper writer, a magazine writer, and I loved writing, and I loved so much. And gradually, that all died. All died. And so when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, particularly the second time, because the first time I wasn't an alcoholic. But when I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was dead spiritually. I mean, I couldn't smile. I was filled with self-pity. I was filled with hate. I didn't realize I hated myself, but I knew I hated you. You know, and I had achieved one thing, though. I had gotten over my particular hates. I used to hate particular people or particular nationalities and whatnot, but I had finally reached the point where I hated everybody, you know. It was a hell of an achievement, you know. And it was the guy that became my sponsor that told me that the reason why I hated everybody was because I hated myself. I was filled with self-loathing. I used to call myself names. I won't mention any because my wife made me promise to be spiritual. But I used to call myself Well Doo-Doo. How's that? Right? You know, Well Doo-Doo. Because it lays at the bottom of the ocean. You can't go any lower than that, you know. You know the kind of things we used to call ourselves, you know. But that's where I was, and that's where alcoholism got me. Not alcohol. Yeah. That was a primary motivator. It enabled her to get me there, but it was all that stuff inside that just decayed, and that's where I got. And that's why I love laughter. That's why I loved, you know, what you guys did for me last night. That's why I love what you guys have done for me all weekend. I love to laugh. You know, the first time I laughed, my sponsor nudged me and said, "You're finally getting it." I used to sit around in these rooms wondering what the hell you were laughing at. Gee, that meant I went flying off this cliff. Boom! Everybody laughs. Flying off a goddamn cliff and they're laughing, you know. And then they dragged me into the emergency room. My arm is cut. My teeth are knocked out. My hair is... Ha, 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 ha.
God, what are they laughing at? You know? Don't they know how I feel? What the hell are these bunch of nuts? Oh, jeez. Oh. Oh, anyway. Thank you. Thank you for teaching me how to laugh again, man. Man. Oh. Anyway, where did I start in life? You know, I'm not going to go back to where I started in life. I'll just tell you. And I also, I'm not going to stand here and tell you everybody who caused my alcoholism. I was asked to speak at a panel once on the adult children of alcoholism. And I won't say any more about it than that, but a young woman in her 40s, and she was a young woman in her 40s, was sober 8 years, and she got up and she spent a half hour knocking the hell out of her father, what he did to her. You know, he never beat her, never raped her, none of that stuff, but he drank. Right? And it was his drinking that ruined her entire life. Now here she's sober 8 years, filled with more self-pity than I had ever found in my life, and blaming everybody for her alcoholism, mainly her father. And being a father, I mean, I didn't like that, you know. My father was a roaring alcoholic. I don't blame him for my alcoholism. In fact, I give him credit for some of the funny stories I can tell these days, you know. You know, like, as a friend of mine says, in our house, Christmas Eve was knocked down the tree night, you know. It was a goddamn tree, you know. You go to a wake with my father and his brothers, and you didn't know whether we're going to bury one or four, you know. And my mother, God rest her soul, both of my parents have passed on. I know where they are, and they're having a lot of fun where they are right now. And my mother, you know, she was kind of an angry person at times. But if I lived with my father as his wife, I probably would have been angry at times too. You know, she would get mostly angry when he would come home drunk, and she would try to lock him out, you know, and he'd break through the back door to get in into his own place. And then she'd get the carving knife out of the drawer and start chasing him around the dining room table, yelling for him to stop. Now, my father was an alcoholic, but he wasn't stupid, you know. So my mother didn't cause my alcoholism either, you know. Neither did my Uncle Willie, neither did my Grandma McClintock, my two grandfathers who were alcoholics. I mean, you know, there may be something to this genes thing, you know, if you know Gene, you know. But I remember my sponsor saying, I was talking to him one day early on, and I said, why? I mean, why? You know, I was 28 years old when I finally sobered up. I said, why? You know? He said, what the hell difference does it make, why? He said, if you went to a doctor and he told you you got cancer, and you said, why? And he said, well, because you smoked 15 packs of cigarettes a day and you worked in the asbestos factory. Thank you. Excuse me, I'm dry. I'm not nervous at all. I'll just keep talking and we'll think about it. And specify, and they finally told you. Did I say asbestos? And so you finally found out how you got it. Doesn't change a damn thing, you still got it. He says, there's only one thing that counts is what do you do about it when you got it? And that's alcoholism. What do you do about it when you got it? Our problem is, my problem was, I denied it for so long. But thank God, you know, thank God he keeps giving us opportunities. With cancer, it's a little different. You keep denying it, and it's going to keep growing worse.
alcoholism is too. It's going to keep growing worse. But we keep getting, see, with alcoholism, I mean, we can come back. We can get sober and we can get well if we let cancer get too far, you know. But anyway, doesn't make any difference how I got it. I'm not blaming anybody. I am an alcoholic because of me, okay? I am physically, mentally, and spiritually different, is what I'm told, and I believe it. And so it's what I do about it that counts. Getting back to this spirit thing, as a young man, I wanted to become a priest. Now, to hold your laughter for a minute, I decided at a young age that I was going to become a Maryknoll missionary priest. And I was going to go over to China, and I was going to save all the Chinese. See? This is even before Bill Clinton saved them, you know. Anyway, I went away to a seminary and studied for 5 years until my spiritual director called me into his office one day and said, William, so I knew he was a little bit teed off when he called me William, you know. I had just played in a basketball game in front of a bunch of nuns and punched the referee in the mouth for calling a fifth personal foul on me. And he said, while I had a lot of zeal, and he thought one day I might be a wonderful father, but he said, not in this place, you know. So I came out into the world from the seminary. In the seminary, what they mean by the world is where all the women are. That's the world, see. Worldly things, you know. So I came out into the world. Now, I had been a very uptight guy before I went into the seminary, you know. You know, like all of us, I think one of the characteristics that I identified with so much, with so many people in AA is, you know, this feeling of not quite feeling equal to, you know, this low self-esteem, we call it, you know. And I had been like that all my life. I never just felt like I quite fit in. You know, there was a missing piece somewhere, you know. So now I come out of the seminary having been away from the world for a long time, and hell, I'd see a girl and I'd blush. That changed pretty quickly, but I, you know, and I got a job working for a newspaper. Some of you with the same color hair that I have might remember the New York Journal American with the big red headline. It was back in the days when, believe it or not, New York City had 17 newspapers. Believe it or not. Now it's got 2.5, you know. You can decide which is the half. Yeah. And I started off as a copy boy. I was going to St. John's University to finish my education. And I decided I didn't need St. John's University because now I was going to be a big shot newspaper man. And anyway, I broke a story. Something happened and I broke a story. And they made me a newspaper reporter. I was 18 years old, wet behind the ears, scared to death. And they sent me over to Brooklyn, to Brooklyn Police Headquarters, and put me on a police beat on the lobster shift. That's midnight until 9 o'clock in the morning, which is when most things happen in Brooklyn anyway, right? I said to the city editor, what do I do as a newspaper reporter? And he said, go over to the headquarters and introduce yourself to the other reporters, and they'll show you the ropes. That's the way you learned the job back then. A lot of jobs you learned that way, and still do, as a matter of fact. So I went up to the lieutenant on the desk at Brooklyn Police Headquarters, and I asked him where I could find the other newspaper reporters, and he pointed across Flatbush Avenue to the Edison Bar and Grill. And he said, you'll find some of them in there. And he was wrong. I found all of them in there, you know. And I walked in, and I asked the bartender if he could introduce me to one of the reporters, because I didn't know any of them, and he introduced me to Joey George of the Daily News. Little short guy, always had a half a pint in each pocket. I was always ready for action, you know. And Joey bought me a drink. And then he introduced me to Charlie Feeney of the Daily Mirror, and Charlie bought me a drink. And then he introduced me to Charlie Robinson of the New York Times, and Charlie Robinson bought me a drink, and they passed me down the bar, you know. I walked into the Edison Bar Grill about midnight,
a scared, uptight 18-year-old rookie police reporter, and I walked out at 4 o'clock in the morning a veteran newsman. That's what alcohol did for me, just like that. Just like that. You know, it's like a friend of mine who had never been to a dance before, an Irish guy from New Rochelle, and his buddies get him up, and he doesn't want to go in the dance hall, so they bring him into the men's room, and they feed him a half a pint, and he walks out the other door, Fred Astaire, you know. I was sharing at one of the alcathons about his friend of mine in California who says, one of the reasons, and I'd like to share this with our friend who's sober 2 days, that one of the reasons so many of us don't make it in Alcoholics Anonymous is because AA takes time. It doesn't happen overnight. We have slogans like, give time, time. Don't leave before the miracle happens. We have these for a reason, that we have to stay and listen and learn, accept and practice and begin. But with alcohol, it's entirely different. Alcohol is fast, man. I mean, with 8 or 10 shots, I mean, I was the tight end for the New York Giants. You know, with 15 or 16 shots, I was an astronaut before the space age, you know. It happened fast. I could be anything I wanted to be. I could get out of any trouble that I was in up here, you know. I could go from really down to really up, and then from really up to really down, you know. I drank because I was cold, and I drank because I was hot to cool off. I drank because I was sad to cheer up. I drank because I was happy to get happier. I drank because I wanted to dance and I couldn't dance. I wanted to drink because I wanted to ask a girl to go on a date, and I drank because I needed a drink to take her on the date, you know. I go on and on and on. Alcohol, without my realizing it, began to control my entire life. Now, if you had told me that at the time, I wouldn't have agreed with you a bit. But it began to control every aspect of my life. I began to drink to get ready to live. I began to drink to get ready to do things. I didn't do it consciously. It just became part of my life. It's an insidious disease that just creeps up and takes over. And it took over every aspect of my life. And as a result of that, I began to give up and give away and walk away from everything that was near and dear to me in my life. I loved playing basketball. I loved playing softball. I became a sitter on Monahan's saloon stool rather than part of his team down at the park, you know. Or I would go to the park and sit on the sidelines and drink the beer. I'd be the one that would break the keg before the game was over, you know, kind of stuff. And that was just the beginning. I mean, later on, I nearly drank up a wonderful family. I drank up wonderful jobs. I drank up a faith that I believed in. I drank up my self-respect. I gave it all away for another drink. And that's what we do as alcoholics. Everything else becomes second, third, or fourth place. And King Alcohol, as someone read at one of the alcathons, takes over and begins to rule my life. And I had no idea that was happening. I went from a police reporter to covering Manhattan headquarters, to covering the criminal courts. They found out I could write. They brought me inside on night rewrite. I began to write the stories for the paper. Then they found out I could write well, and they promoted me to dayside rewrite. I found myself writing for 7 editions a day. When I was 21 years old, I was a byline feature writer for the largest evening newspaper in the world. I say that because that's a fact. When I was 24 years old, I was the obituary editor for the largest evening newspaper in the world. Now, you don't get your name above an obituary unless you're really dead, you know. So I didn't get any bylines for that. I wound up as the obituary editor because I got fired 5 times, all directly as a result of drinking. The first time I got fired for wrapping up my car while being drunk on the job. I was on my way to cover a 5-alarm fire going to general, mean all-out fire, in the Brooklyn Navy Yard one night, and I was going from Monahan Saloon. So I left with a 6-pack and a bottle. It was a summer night. I had this beautiful powder blue convertible, and I'm driving along Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn at 80 miles an hour.
you know, sipping my booze, sipping my beer, listening to the music, and enjoying my grandiosity as a great newspaper man. And I forgot at one point that the train goes back down underground. 80 miles an hour into that stanchion. Boom! Yeah. And I come to in Jewish Hospital in the emergency room, and there are doctors and nurses around me, and they've got something in my mouth. And what happened is I lost part of my tongue and busted some of my teeth and busted six ribs, and I was cut all over the place. And what I do remember, you know, we come out of blackouts in some of the damnedest places, and what I do remember is there was one doctor that was ready to stitch up my tongue and wire up my jaw, and he opened my eye, and he said, we ought to give him a little anesthesia before we operate, and the other doctor says, this guy doesn't need a thing. Oh. So when I got out of the hospital, I went over to my mom and dad's place, and all my friends from the bars came to visit me. You know, alcoholics, we love to visit the sick and bury the dead as though there's a bottle around, you know. And they were passing the bottle when it came to me, and here I'm sitting with my wired up jaw, and my father grabs the bottle, and he says, you shouldn't have any hard stuff. And he takes a bottle of Christian Brothers sherry wine, and he hands it to me. And he says, this will ease the pain. So I began clucking Christian Brothers sherry wine through my wired up jaw. You know, if you cluck enough of it, you can get pretty drunk. And you can get pretty sick. And if you ever try to puke through a wired up jaw, you know, yeah. You know. Yeah. The big pieces come out of your ears, you know. So anyway, I swore off Christian Brothers sherry wine, you know. I'll just tell you one other quick story about my journey through the newspaper business. In 1955, the Brooklyn Dodgers, the Wait Till Next Year team, finally beat the Yankees for the very first time and brought the World Series to Brooklyn. Remember that? There's a guy 15 years old. I mean, he'll lie as much as I do. Jesus. So the city editor says to me, Bill, I want you to do the lead story for tomorrow's paper, big feature story on, you know, how Brooklyn feels about finally winning the World Series. So I want you to go to Brooklyn, interview the people, and come back and, you know, and write an article for tomorrow's paper. Will be the lead story. I said, fine, Eddie. Eddie Mahar was my city editor then. An angry, angry, angry alcoholic who stopped drinking on his own and hated every slug of humanity. He was the only man I knew that could string together 17 profane words and make a perfect English sentence. I mean, that's how angry he was, you know. So I said, all right, Eddie, so I go, now where does an alcoholic go to interview the people in Brooklyn? I hit every bar in Brooklyn. Luckily, I had a photographer with me, Mel Finkelstein, wonderful guy. Remember Burnett? What a wonderful guy. He didn't drink, and he used to drive around a radio car. Anyway, Mel was with me, and he was dragging me in and out of these places and dusting me off whenever I needed to be dusted off and telling me we ought to get back to the office. And the last thing I remember, I was at the Brooklyn Dodgers party, signing my name to the back of Sandy Amoros. I don't know if anybody remembers Sandy Amoros, who was an outfielder for the Dodgers. And Roy Campanella had torn his shirt off, and everybody was autographing his back, you know. Then I remember I'm sitting at my typewriter at the City Room in the Journal American, and the Night City editor, Art McGovern, Art McClure, well, you wouldn't know who the hell he were anyway, so. both McGovern and McClure were alcoholics just like me. So. And Art McClure screaming for the story. And I'm coming out of a blackout. And I've got notes all over the place, you know, and clippings from other papers, and the copy boys are bringing me coffee, and it's about 6:45, and our deadline is 7:30, and I'm writing a lead story. So I finally start writing. When I get finished with the story, and the copy boy brings it over to the city desk, I'm trying to sneak out of the office, and McClure screams at me, Borchardt, get over here. And I walk over to the city desk, and Art McClure looks up at me, and he says to me, Bill, from now on, I want you to come into work the way you came in this morning because you're a much better writer drunk than you ever were sober. Now, if that won't tell you that alcoholism, that alcohol is your friend, I don't know what will. So it just subconsciously reinforced. You know, and it made such an impression on me that I can remember the lead that I wrote on that story. It's crazy, isn't it? Like a mighty comet roaring down from outer space, the realization that its beloved bums had finally won the World Series struck this borough last night with a mighty roar. What a show-off, huh? What a show-off. And 3 years later, I was the obituary editor. Because my alcoholism progressed. And I wanted to spend more time in Moochie's. Moochie's, by the way, was a wonderful saloon right near the East River in New York. And what I liked about it most is that when the tide would come in, it would flood the basement and overflow the toilets. And the aroma in this place, you would probably love it, Gay. I mean, you know. It just made me feel at home. It made me feel like I was, you know. So I didn't even do an honest job at the obituary job. You know, they kept wanting fresh obits. They wanted me to call up funeral homes and find out what well-known people dropped dead that night. And I didn't want to do that because I was busy at Moochie's. And so I would steal the obituaries out of other newspapers. I would paste them up and send them into the composing room. And then they would start, you know, then I'd get notes in my box from the editor saying, we want fresh obits. We don't want people who died, you know, 2 days ago. And then when I sent it in, one guy had paper had been laying around, so I tore it out and sent it in, and the guy had died 2 weeks ago. Yeah. He wasn't fresh at all, you know. So I knew traveling all over the country, interviewing famous people, going to places I'd always wanted to be, and wherever I went, you know, I'd get drunk, go into a blackout, just about make my deadlines, and that job only lasted 3.5 years. I was about to get fired from that, and then I quit that job, and I got a job in the public relations business in New York. See, every PR man I had ever met was a drunk, so I thought I'd be safe in that business, but that only lasted me 6 months. So I can trace the progressiveness of this disease in my job life. I can trace it in my home life. You know, I have been engaged a couple of times and to a couple of different girls, and this one night after this other girl finally made sense enough to break off her engagement, I won't go into that story, I walked into this place that I used to hang out. I had a dance hall in the back, and it was this lovely looking, beautiful, still is, woman, gal sitting back there. I asked her to dance, and 3.5 weeks later we danced off to Elton, Maryland, and got married. Well, actually, it was a very sincere proposal. See, I used to like to get my dates home by midnight so I could have 4 more hours to drink on my own. And this particular night, I said to Bernard, you know, let me take you home. And she said, no. I said, what do you want to do? She said, I want to stay with you. And it had been so long since anybody said they wanted to stay with me. I said, okay, let's get married. Yeah. And so we got married. We drove down to Maryland. We got married. And she should have known something was wrong when she told me she was hungry. And I drove into town, and I bought her an 8-cent loaf of Wonder Bread and 1/2 pound of bologna and 4 roses for myself, you know. Bernadette came from a wonderful Italian family. Is 16, only one brother in the whole family, maybe one boy and all those girls. I used to think her brother was a little strange. I asked him once, I said, what's it like growing up with all those sisters? And he said to me, you know, I didn't know until I was 13 that I didn't have to sit down to pee, you know. Wonderful. He's a great guy. And Bernadette had a mother. Her father had died when Bernadette's father died when Bernadette was only 8. Bernadette was the last in the family. As a matter of fact, she had two older sisters who were older than my mother. Yeah. So, and then there was Bernadette's mother, whom I came to hate with a passion, because she was always praying for me. See, we were married, and I now found it very, very difficult, you know, being a husband. Now we're expecting our first child, and a community citizen, and all that stuff, and an alcoholic at the same time. You know, they don't all go together, so something's got to go. So everything went, but the alcohol, you know. And I began to find it tough, you know, bringing home a paycheck. So I began, I never forget one Friday afternoon, I was coming home, I had no money on payday. And I passed by this little shop with a glass window, and it said Beneficial Finance Company on the front window, you know. And there was a guy behind the counter smiling, give me a wave, you know. So I walked in, and all I did is sign this piece of paper, and he gave me $50. I said, wow, you know, that was easy. I thought he had to check on my, you know, whole history. But 30 days later, they wanted a payment. So I went over to, you know, another loan company. And I borrowed $100. I paid back the $50. They wanted a payment, so I went over to another loan company. So I borrowed $200, paid back $100. Then I had a night city editor, Joe McGovern. This is McGovern now, who was a roaring alcoholic like me, and he had a friend at Local Loan. And he said, I can get you $400 local if you can sign a, you know, one for me over at Household. I said, okay, fine. So we signed each other's things, and I borrowed $400 from Local, and I paid back $200. I thought I found the key to financial success. Had a lot of gold keys from the finance company, you know. And when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I owed 5 finance companies, 3 banks, 2 loan sharks, and my Aunt Jenny. And Aunt Jenny was the only one that didn't charge vigorous and had more patience than the others, you know. And my loan shark, God, I just have to tell this quick story in case I forget. One of my loan sharks was a guy named Richie Baldino. Isn't that a wonderful name for a loan shark? Richie Baldino. I tell this because it's my prayer for Richie. Richie was a heavyset guy who walked with a limp, you know, and he had a shillelagh kind of a cane. And he and his brother carried their own book, you know. They weren't really, I don't think, really connected, you know. But I owed Richie Baldino, when I came into AA, $17,500. I had never borrowed that much from him. I don't remember how much, but I know I'd never borrowed that much, you know. But the vigorish, you know, 5 for 10, yeah, that's a lot, you know. I mean, I'm making payments, it's really a lot. And every time I'd see Richie at Moochie's, he always used to say, I'm going to break your legs. I'm going to break your effing legs. And if I was drunk enough, I'd you know, stick him out, you know. He didn't like that. You know, and he wasn't a bad guy. He really wasn't. Anyway, I'm now sobering up in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was sober about a month, maybe a little over a month, and I get word that Richie Baldino just dropped dead of a heart attack. And I said to my sponsor, Benny, I said, what do? I owe this guy $17,500. What do? And then he said, you pray for him. You know? So that's my prayer for Richie Baldino, you know. And the other reason I like to share that is if, and I'm sure there's somebody here today that's got something going on in their life that's really weighing them down, and you think it's never going to go away. God works things out in very strange ways, you know. So if he handled my Richie Baldino, he'll handle your problem too, you know. My mother-in-law lent us some money. We bought a 2-family house. I drank that up. We bought a 1-family house in Deer Park, Long Island. I drank that up. And by 1961, we wound up living in my mother-in-law's basement. And I was very sick physically, mentally, and spiritually. We had 4 children at the time. I had dragged my wife into this disease of alcoholism, and she was as sick as I was, and neither of us knew it. I was now not coming home very much. I was waking up in places that I had not checked into.
I was waking up in cities that I knew I hadn't flown to. And in the beginning it was scary, but you get used to it. Isn't it incredible? Isn't it incredible the things that we accept as alcoholics in our lives? You know, and then we argue with the second step. By 1961, as I say, I was a walking fruitcake. I weighed about 320 pounds. I was known on 47th Street in New York as the moon. Because every time I walk into their joints, they'd say, look, the moon is out tonight. You know, and I'd walk in, you know. And I'd have to laugh, because if I didn't laugh, they wouldn't serve me and stuff like that. So anyway, that's, you know. I was sitting in a Third Avenue bar one night, and you know how we don't know where it comes from sometimes. All of a sudden, I was again overcome by fear. Yeah, I was 27 years old. I had once had wonderful jobs. I have a wonderful wife back in the basement, four great kids. And here I am. What's going on? And filled with this anger and this self-pity, and why am I doing this? Now, by this time, I had tried to stop. Not really stop, you know. I had tried to slow down, you know. I had tried to change the direction of my life. I mean, I had tried going back to church. I had talked to a priest. I had promised my wife many times, never again, I swear. And I did it again, and again, and again. And by this time, the hopelessness was total. And I finally reached the conclusion, and somebody said this at a meeting the other day, that I was convinced I was insane. If not insane, on the verge of insanity. Because you don't do these kind of things if you're not nuts. And as a result of that, one night one of our children got sick, had to be taken to the hospital, and I met Bernard at this little restaurant, and I ordered a bunch of drinks, and she ordered something to eat, and she looked at me, and she had said this before, and I used to hate to hear it. She asked me a question, why are you doing this to yourself? Yeah, she would scream and holler, but the thing I hated the most when she would look at me and she'd say, why are you doing this to yourself? Do you know what you're doing to yourself? And this particular night, I broke down. It wasn't crocodile tears, you know, what we like to use, you know. I just fell apart. And then I told her what I thought I was crazy. Now, you should never confess those kinds of things to my wife. She's a woman of action. So she called our family doctor, and the following Saturday afternoon, I find myself sitting in front of a psychiatrist. I didn't feel too bad going to see him, because as I was walking in, there were two nuns walking out. And I said to myself, he just said, nun's got to see a nut doctor. I can't be that bad, you know. So I sit in front of this guy. I lay my belly on his desk. I look like Porky Pig with a hangover, you know. And he asked me why I was there, and I told him because I thought I was crazy. And he asked me why. And I began to tell him things, you know, like checking into places I didn't know I had, or being in places I know I had checked into, and waking up on subway trains with people staring at me, not knowing why, until I looked at my lap, which was covered with you-know-what, you know. And then he stopped me, and he said, oh, you drink, don't you? And I straightened up, and I said, yeah, I have a few now and then. He said, what do you mean by a few? Is that like a few beers with the boys on weekends? I said, that's exactly what I mean. He said, well, aside from drinking beer on weekends with the boys, you ever drink beer on Mondays or Tuesdays? I said, yeah. You ever drink beer on Wednesdays, Thursdays, or Fridays? I said, yeah. He said, do you ever drink any rye? I said, yeah. Do you ever drink any scotch? I said, yeah. I'm not kidding. This is. He said, you ever drink any vodka? I said, yeah. Do you ever drink any gin? I said, yeah. Do you ever drink any wine? I said, well, I don't drink Christian Brothers sherry wine. I remember the look on his face, you know. But what he was trying to do was to paint a picture of a guy who was 27 who drank every day in the week anything he could get his hands on, you know. And then he said to me, Bill, do you know what an alcoholic is? Oh, yeah, there was a question I could answer, you know. I said, I certainly do. And I described the guy, you remember, gay, right? The guy sitting on a Bowery, picking lint out of his navel. To me, yeah, that's, you know. He said, yeah, but that's an alcoholic in the final stages of his disease. He said, that guy wasn't born down there. He was born probably in a nice place like you, maybe even nicer. And through the use and abuse of alcohol, he wound up on the Bowery. And then he began to talk to me about the disease of alcoholism. And I suddenly began to suspect that he was inferring that I was an alcoholic. And I got, I don't know if this is a bad word, I got pissed off. I mean, I really did. I mean, and it was like a clear plexiglass screen came down to me. I kept seeing his lips move, but I wasn't hearing the thing, you know. And then I hear, if you are an alcoholic, I can't help you. And for some reason or other, my heart sank. Now, I was insulted, but at the same time, I came to this guy because I wanted help. But I wanted it on my terms. I thought he'd give me, you know, the, you know, three or four suggestions. I go home, I put them into practice, and I'd be, you know, cured of my nuttiness, or whatever I thought I had. But he said, I know some people who can help you, and he gave me the phone number of the Intergroup Office of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, if you want help, go see these people. If you don't want, don't come back to see me, because it costs $25 a visit. This is in 1961. And if you want to keep on drinking, you're going to need the money. I mean, he was a very straight guy. You know? So I go over to New York, and I walked into the Intergroup office, which somebody said the other day, it's true, it was at Lexington Avenue on, I think, 28th Street. And if you walk in the front door, you can look out the back, and there were a couple of guys shaking it off out in the yard. And there was a guy named John, introduced himself, a well-dressed guy. He was a volunteer for the day. And he said to me, I said, I'm Bill from... I was then from Richmond Hill, Queens, and he said, do you have a problem with alcohol? And I said, no, but there's a psychiatrist back in Queens that thinks I do. He sent me over here. And he said, oh, would you like to go to an AA meeting? And I thought, you know, you make an appointment, you know, like a week from Sunday or something, you know. And I said, okay. I said, when? He said, well, we'll go tonight. I said, tonight? Oh. I can't do that. I'm kind of busy tonight, you know. So he said, all right. He said, and he handed me his card. I never will forget it. It was John So-and-so, vice president of Chase Manhattan Bank. And I was running short, you know. I got to get to know this guy, you know. So I said, all right, John, where would you like to go tonight? And that's how God got me to my first AA meeting. I mean, I'm sure he got you there some strange way too, right? You know? And that's... So I go to my first meeting and, you know, I hear this guy's talk and whatnot, and I'm not paying any attention really because, you know, I'm not an alcoholic, you know. I'm just letting time pass till things cool down, you know. And then after the meeting, they gather around me, you know, and they gave me a book. They said, Richmond Hill, you meet on Tuesdays and Saturdays. You go to your home group meeting. Well, I couldn't tell them I couldn't go to Richmond Hill. I didn't want anybody to know I was going to AA, you know. I never thought about the fact that 3 o'clock Saturday afternoon they'd see me urinating on their hedges, you know. But to go to Alcoholics Anonymous? Oh, God forbid, you know. So I went 3 miles out of my way to the Woodhaven group. I stayed around for about Woodhaven, yeah. I stayed. At that time, they met in an American Legion Hall. It was a Monday night, I never will forget it, and they had it, must have had a big blast Sunday night, because as I walked downstairs, the place smelled of beer. And I said, man, I'm in the right place. and there was a guy behind the bar with one of these metal pitchers, you know, that you have beer in. And I'm looking for a glass, you know, and he hands me a cup. I said, oh, you drink out of cups? All right, so. And then suddenly he pours me a cup of coffee. Hell, I don't want any coffee. That was Woodhaven. Anyway, I stayed around about 2.5 months. It took me that long to prove to everybody, mainly myself, that I wasn't an alcoholic. And again, my friend with 2 days. Try to identify, not, you know, with what we look like or what we sound like or even the way we drank, but the way we felt. I didn't do that. I compared myself to everybody who was different than me, who had done things that I hadn't done, who had gone further than I had gone. And then I walked out. They told me if I was an alcoholic and if I had anything else left to lose, I'd lose it. And they were absolutely right. A year later, I came to at the Margarita Hotel on East 21st Street in New York. I woke up, tried to pull my face from the mattress because it was a dollar a night, $1.50 with a sheet, you know. And 50 cents was a lot, you know. A couple of cans of beer back in 1962. And I staggered into the bathroom. I looked in the mirror, and I was... I'm sorry, Gabe, but you remember, you know. And you remember the feelings. And I couldn't handle it anymore. So I went outside and I crawled out on the window ledge. And it was the eighth floor, and it was an air shaft. It didn't face the street, it was an air shaft. And I crawled out on the window ledge and I looked down. And I decided I had it. At 28 years old, my life was over. I just couldn't handle it anymore. And everything I had piled up, you know, by this time I had two DAs looking for me on bad check charges. I had a wife I knew who hated my guts and children who were afraid of me. And a mother-in-law who did nothing but sit at a dining room table praying for me, you know. I used to hate that. To get out to the basement, I had to pass by the dining room, and there was Mama with two sets of rosary beads. A stack of prayer cards, the New Testament, and the Book of the Saints. And I would stand there and I would scream at her, "Stay out of my goddamn life. I don't need you in my life," you know. And Mama, this beautiful spiritual lady, would just continue to pray. Bernard wanted to leave me when I was drinking, and Mama said to her, "You can't leave him now because he's sick." She knew that I was sick. She never berated me. I couldn't understand. She had an insight. And then when I was sober about 3 or 4 months and was unbearable to live with because I now knew everything, she said, "Mom, I can't stand him. I got to leave him." Mom said, "You can't leave him now. Somebody else will get all the good stuff, you know." So anyway, I'm sitting on this ledge, and there's a lot of telephone lines crisscrossing. I couldn't find a clear spot. I felt if I jumped out, I'd hit a wire and hurt myself, you know. So I came back in, and I went home, and I figured on the way home, I'm going to tell my wife that she doesn't have to leave me. I'm going to leave her. She'll be better off without me. She can get on welfare, and, you know, all this kind of self-pity stuff, you know. And before I left the house, the basement, Bernadette looked at me and she said to me, "I've taken everything that you had to give me for 8.5 years. Before you leave me, do you think you owe me one last favor?" And I said, "I guess so." And she said, "For God's sakes, why don't you give AA another try?" Now, if that's not love, and why she was there still. And she called somebody and they called me back, and a guy named Joe, who I had met a year before, and he said, "Would you like to try AA again?" And I said, "Yeah, I guess so." I didn't say it. God said it for me. And they picked me up, and they brought me back to the Woodhaven Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was April 8th of 1962. And through the grace of God and you and all those wonderful guys who have now gone to the big AA meeting in the sky, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink one day at a time since. You know? And that applause is for all of us who are sitting here today sober. And now, what has it been like? It's been absolutely wonderful. The beginning was tough, you know, because I had no hope. I had no hope. You know, the empty feeling and the confusion. I mean, they say to you, "You come in, just sit and listen." Hell, I couldn't listen. I had too damn much noise in my head. I'd sit there and I'd think about the loan shark, Richie, because he was still, you know, looking for me at that time. The DAs, my wife, you know, my life. Can I ever get a decent job again? Because now I was unemployable. Nobody wanted me, even in a big city like New York. And But Benny helped me through it. The first thing he let me do was to wash mugs in the kitchen sink in the Woodhaven group. When I put my hands in that hot, soapy water, something happened to me, and I'm not making this up. I'm not being melodramatic. You know from your own experience what service, whatever that service is, what it does for us. It made me feel like a different kind of a person, you know? Like I did have some value, you know? And then I got promoted to making coffee. And in those days, it was only a 3-month commitment. And then they wanted to take me off making coffee. I got my first resentment, you know? Because when you're there in the kitchen by yourself and the guys come in and the gals come in, and actually we only had one lady at the time, a gal named Vi, and every time we needed to make a close-up call on a woman, she was always drunk. but Vi got sober, stayed sober. But anyway, and then Benny led me through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he put me on a path to sobriety. He said to me that I couldn't stay sober. The kind of person I was, I needed to change. I needed to change everything in my life. Everything. Halfway measures would avail me nothing. You know, I couldn't just talk the talk. I had to really walk the walk. I had to be willing to go to any length, any length. He said to me, in Alcoholics Anonymous, if you have to do something, say yes first and think about it later. He said to me, there's only one way to stay sober. And that's the way we get sober. Whether we're sober 2 days or 45 years, right? There's only one way to stay sober, and that's the way we get sober. At one time in my sobriety, I thought I could go on a glide path, you know? Didn't need as many meetings and didn't need to do this and all this kind of stuff. No. Through the grace of God, I almost got drunk, but I didn't. I want to tell you, I've told you all of my troubles. I want to share with you now a lot of stuff that, or some stuff, a little bit of stuff, that I used to not want to share because I always wanted you to think I'm a nice, humble soul, you know, not a braggart, you know, I don't have any more ego, you know, all this kind of stupid stuff. That isn't me. Because a lot of wonderful things have happened in my life as a result of being sober. The first thing is I was able to dream again. You know what happens in our drinking? We lose all of our dreams. You know, no matter who we are, no matter where we're from, we have our dreams. And if you're anything like me, I lost all of my dreams. So I finally came in Alcoholics Anonymous and I began to get sober, and things began to happen in my life. Only because I put sobriety first. You know, once I put sobriety first, I have plenty of time for everything else. You know, I got into that mindset too, where I wanted to make up for all the stuff that I had done and make up for it right now. And it takes time. I had to create a balance in my life. That'd take time. Anyway, I got a job. A PR guy that I knew gave me a job and paid me $25 a week every day I showed up. He said, if you don't show up for a couple of weeks, I won't pay you anymore. And I kept showing up, and then he finally put me back on the payroll. And then things were still tough in New York, so I was offered a job in Nashville, Tennessee. Moved down to Nashville, lived in Nashville for 6 years. And the early days of AA in Nashville, it was just wonderful. And then I moved to Cleveland, Ohio, which is right next to the birthplace of Alcoholics Anonymous in Akron, Ohio. And all along the line, I was just meeting some fantastic people. And then I came back to New York in 1968. And by this time, we had more children. You know, we started off with four, as I said, then I sobered up, and then we had five more, you know. Well, because, you know, a lot of things begin to work again when you sober up, you know. And so I want to wrap this up with my God story. Being a spiritual meeting, I want to tell you my God story, and I'll be as brief as I can. I came back to New York, and I was in a PR business for a while, and then I met an investment banker who introduced me to three guys, and who were one of them was in the movie business, and the other two were agents, and we put together a motion picture, talent management and motion picture production company, and we were fairly successful for a while. And I was doing something that I'd always dreamed about doing, making movies. We made a Kansas City Bomber with Raquel Welch. And there's nothing for you that will do more for your spirituality than watch Raquel Welch skating around a roller derby ring in tight-fitting black leather pants. And then we made Serbico and Dog Day Afternoon, and things were going like gangbusters. And then my ego was getting bigger and bigger, so then I decided that what we needed to do was to make a movie about Alcoholics Anonymous so I could save the world. And my partner said, "A movie about what?" As they sipped their scotch, you know. So I got resentment. I left, started my own company, and tried to make a movie about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went through everything we had. And by 1980, we were broke. We were broke, and my wife knew we were broke. And I was on his ego trip. I had written a script, actually, which Columbia Pictures liked, in fact, they wanted to make it, but they didn't want to make it the way I had promised Lois. My wife got to know Lois very well, and Lois gave me her permission to write a movie about her and Bill and Dr. Bob and the whole story. And I wrote the script, and Peter Goober, who ran Columbia Pictures at the time, liked it, but he said we needed a lot of changes. He wanted to make this alcoholic Bill Wilson, you know, running up and down Fifth Avenue, bare-ass, naked, chasing women in and out of hotel rooms, you know, all this kind of stuff, you know. And I said, no, Peter, this is a spiritual movie. And he says, a spiritual movie? Ah, spiritual movies suck. We got to make this, you know. But I had promised Lois, and I was sober, at least trying to be sober, in spite of this enormous ego trip. But I was quite humbled at this point in my life. And so I put the whole project on the back burner and forgot about it for a while. I was speaking one night for a friend of mine up at Casa Serena. If anybody remembers old Casa Serena and Joe LaPiccolo. This guy named Eddie was celebrating his first anniversary, and he told me after the meeting that he was going off to Hollywood to become an actor. He was about 42, 43, and he was divorced and on his own. And he said, "Can I take your script with me?" I let him read my script. And he said, "In case I run into anybody out there that wants to make it." I said, "Sure, Eddie, go ahead." And Eddie was a hustler. He was on All in the Family and the Sanford and Sons and all those kinds of stuff. But he met a lot of producers. And he befriended James Garner's secretary. I didn't know it, and he didn't know it at the time, but James Garner and a guy named Pete DeShow were trying to make a movie about Alcoholics Anonymous. And they had gone through 5 writers and couldn't come up with a script. So he gave my script to Jim Garner's secretary, Mary Ann, and she read it. She brought home and read it for some reason. This is a God story, okay? This is when the Bill is out of the picture, now God is doing his stuff. And so Garner, she says to Garner, "You ought to read this because you're trying to do this." And so Garner takes it home. He reads it. He thinks it's written by a guy that his partner, Peter, had just hired to write another script. He reads it, and he likes it, and he calls up Pete, and he says, "This guy Borchard, you just had to write this thing. It's a pretty good script." He says, "Congratulations." And Peter says, "Who? I never heard of the guy." And he said, "Well, it's a good script." He says, "I think you ought to read it." He says, "I can't. We don't have his permission." He says, "Well, if you don't read it," I says, "I don't want to do this project anymore." So it's Garner and DeShow told me the story. Anyway, sends it over to Peter. Peter reads it. Following Saturday, I'm sitting with my wife in our kitchen in Rye, New York. We had just finished lunch and having a cup of tea. We were all out of decaffeinated coffee. And the telephone rings. And it's Peter DeShow on the phone, Garner's partner. And he says, "Are you Bill Borchard?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "I got to apologize. I've done something wrong. I've read a script of yours without your permission." I said, "What do you mean? What are you talking about?" I didn't know what he was talking about. I had no idea what he was talking about. I didn't even know how it got to him until later on. And he said, "We've been trying to make a movie about Alcoholics Anonymous, and we think your script is terrific, but you wrote it as a feature film, and we're doing this for the Hallmark Hall of Fame. Would you be interested in rewriting it for television, for a 2-hour television movie?" I said, "I don't know. I'm kind of busy right now." I said, "But if you give me about 5 minutes," and that's how it happened in my life. I hung up the phone and Bernard and I cried in each other's arms. because it had become God's time. You see, as you know and I know and often forget, that things happen in God's time. Not when I want them to happen, but in God's time. And this was God's time. Pete came to New York, we met, we talked, and I rewrote. I brought the script up to Lois, made a date with her, sat on her back porch up at Stepping Stones. If you haven't been there, please go. I read the script. It took 3.5 hours. I keep forgetting now. We had 7 pee breaks, I think 6 for her and 1 for me. And when I got all finished, she said, Bill, this is... She said, Bill would have loved this. Nothing about Lois. Lois was the most unassuming, gentle, humble woman I've ever known. Like my mother-in-law. Really. Really. And anyway, I wish that Lois had stayed alive until we made the movie. And so the following year, we produced a movie called My Name is Bill W. for the Hallmark Hall of Fame. That's another applause for the higher power. Because without all my false humility, it's true. This is what happened. This is God's. And finally, to close it, because I'm overtime, a minute overtime, I think, here, I'll just tell you that Jimmy Woods wanted to play Bill Wilson very badly. As a matter of fact, Jimmy Woods and Jim Garner had just finished a movie called Promise up in Seattle. They were at Seattle Airport in the restaurant, and Garner and Peter DeShow were talking about making Bill W., and Jimmy Woods was in the other booth having a cup of coffee with another actor, and he heard. And he ran over to them and said, I'm Bill W. He read every book there is to read on the subject. His first wife had been in Al-Anon, so he knew all about this program. And he's a wonderful, wonderful actor. And crazy as a hoop, but wonderful, wonderful guy. And he wanted to go to meetings in Richmond, Virginia, where we shot it. We took him to a meeting. And in those days, you could smoke down in Richmond, Virginia. And he was sitting there in the seat. He had a cup of coffee. He put it down next to him to light a cigarette, and as he did, he was so nervous, he knocked the coffee over. And an elderly jet sitting next to him patted him on the knee and said, that's all right, son. I was nervous at my first meeting, too. And Jimmy lit up like a Christmas tree. He'd become an alcoholic, you know? So that's my God story. And I'm hoping God his time is coming soon for something else. But anyway, in closing, I want to just close by sharing one other incident with my mother-in-law, whom I had came to hate with a passion, and in sobriety came to love as much as I've ever been able to love anybody in my entire life. Because Jimmy was asking me before the meeting, Mama, she's one of the reasons you're here. She's a big reason why I'm here. We were in Nashville now, and we were having, I don't know, our 5th child or 6th child. And Mama came down to take care of Bernadette and the kids. And Bernadette went to bed, and the kids were in bed, and I was getting ready to do some writing, and Mama came in to say her prayers into the den. And she sat down next to me on the couch. And Mama looked up at me, and she said to me, all of my life I've been reading about Jesus and all the miracles that he did, and I've been reading in the New Testament about all the miracles that the apostles did. And she said, I've often wondered what it would be like to witness a miracle. And then she put her hand on my shoulder. And she said, now I have. And now I have. Thank you very much.